Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
Good evening. It is time to go ahead and get started here. And I don't see Dale. I promised Dale on Sunday I would do this, and then ran out of time toward the end of class, just like he told me I was going to. And then, so I promised him I would start class this time with this. So this is our website. If you've ever gone to our website, I know it's kind of whited out on the screen. We have them maxed out on brightness for the projectors. But if you want to hear any of the classes, it's really easy to get to. All you do is you'll see right up there in the main bar, there's the media and sermons. Just move the cursor over that and go back up there, Ron. And then go down to all Bible classes and click that. And then if you'll just scroll down a little bit, Ron, you'll see that there's this list of all the classes. And you can see the ones we put on there lately. But if you go to that series column, you can pick church history, summer of 2013, hit the filter button. And what that will do is it will list all of the classes, and we have them all recorded. So if you want to go back and listen to a class you missed or any of those kind of things, feel free to do so. They're all recorded there. One of the things that we've been asked a lot about is recording this class. So we went ahead and did that, and I went back and added some of the classes before we started doing that on here. Eventually, I would like to see us get to a point, and one of the things that I've kind of put forward to the elders this year as a thing to start considering for future development is to record all of our adult Bible classes and be able to have them out there online so that if someone misses a class, they can go back and listen. But for now, you can just hear ours. That's the only one that matters anyway. Go ahead and switch me back over, Ron. Thank you. Okay, we are going to be covering the second part of the Reformation tonight. This is class number 25, which if you're counting, means we are down to less than 10 left. In fact, I think 8 or 9 classes left. It'll be August tomorrow, can you believe it? So we're going to try to get through all of this tonight so that we can continue down our class here. And I have to tell you, I want to just kind of preface today's class by the farther we get down this road, the more into class we get, it seems like the farther behind I am in studying. We've been trying to keep up as we go. This was a class that both Marcus and I have had to study a tremendous amount to try to teach. And I got to tell you, the farther we get, the less qualified I feel to teach this class. So we will do the best we can for today. Just as a quick review, we talked about what is Reformation. You may remember we put this chart up here with the idea that whenever the change has happened, that you have to decide, what am I going to do? I'm either going to try to fix what we have, reform what we already have back into what it was before, or we just get to the point where we have to restart. And we said that those two ideas are what we call the Reformation and the Restoration movements. So we are clearly here in this idea of the Reformation, people who are trying to return the church to what it was before. And we talked quite a bit on Sunday about the big problem with that was, what are you returning to? So we're not going to cover that again tonight. I did want to just briefly hit the list of the causes of the Reformation again, in case you were not here on Sunday. So the secular causes of the Reformation, we identified four, two of which are really important. The idea of the Dark Ages ending, the beginning of the Renaissance period, and the two that were most critical of the secular reasons are the creation of the printing press and the translation of the Bible. We're going to continue to talk a little bit about the translation of the Bible tonight. We looked at some of the practices of the Catholic Church in the Dark Ages and just immediately following into the period of the Reformation that really were what was rebelled against. Simony and nepotism. I didn't really say this on Sunday, and so I got a lot of questions about it. Simony. Is that a term you've heard before? Simony means buying your position. And it comes after Simon the sorcerer, who tried to do what? Buy the powers, right, from the apostles. Okay, so that term came to be used for people who bought their position in the church, simony. And of course, nepotism is getting in based on your family or your friends. That's how you got into the church, into the hierarchy of the church, a priest or a bishop or something like that. The intermingling of church and state, the church really trying to take over, this idea of the Crusades and the terrible cost that they waged and the fact that they lost, the internal conflict within the church, the split between East, West, and some of those things, the theocratic dominance that they ruled over everything with this impending threat of we're going to excommunicate you or we're going to interdict against your entire city or nation. And the number one reason, the number one practice here was the corruption of the clergy. And two of the guys that we talk about tonight directly take their inspiration or their first idea that there needs to be reform from this corruption of the clergy. And then we did talk about several Catholic doctrines, and I am not going to go through all of them again. There's the first eight or so. I do want to hit the last big three, though, that we did. The idea of relics and images. We start to see at the end of the Dark Ages and during the Dark Ages this idea that anything connected to a saint could become a relic. Their bones, their clothes, a book that they touched, a place that they were. People were ripping up the very stones during the Crusades trying to say, this is a relic because this is where so-and-so must have walked. Okay? And that relic had power that was important to your salvation. And every church that was a true church would have a relic in it. Or if you couldn't have a relic, then you had to have one of these images. A statue or a big painting, stained glass window, those kind of things that represented either Jesus, Mary, or a saint had to be in every single church, and people were worshiping those. In fact, we'll talk about Martin Luther tonight, and one of the things that was upsetting to him the most was there was a statue in a town very near him called the Black Virgin, which was basically a statue of the Virgin Mary that over time had become stained so that it was completely black. And people traveled for thousands of miles just to touch this statue, and they put their faith in this statue. And that just drove Martin Luther up a wall. Mariolatry, along with that, you know, why are we putting up images of Mary? Who was Mary? Why is she important? The Bible says almost nothing about her. How come the Catholic Church puts her on a pedestal? But the most important thing and the most important doctrine of the Catholic Church that really caused the Reformation is this idea of indulgences, that it's okay for us to forgive the physical consequences of sin, because after all, this follows the idea of penance, right? That the church can set you something physical to do to help you expiate your sin. Well, what if you don't want to do that? Well, you can buy an indulgence. And this selling of the indulgences is really what drove them crazy. And we ended up class on Sunday talking about John Tetzel, who was perhaps the most successful and the most renowned salesman of indulgences. Okay. Did anybody have any questions or comments? I know on Sunday I didn't give you a lot of time for that. Before we move on to talk about, we're going to talk about four guys tonight for the Reformation. And everybody wanted to talk on Sunday. Now no one wants to talk. Okay. We're going to talk about two pre-reformers. We're going to talk about a guy named John Wycliffe, and then also a guy named Jan, or John, we would say. Jan is his real first name. Huss, we'll talk about those two guys. And then we're going to talk about two actual reformers. We're going to talk about Martin Luther and John Calvin, arguably the two most important people in the Reformation movement here. So the first pre-reformer that we're going to talk about is this guy named John Wycliffe. And because we are far enough down in history now, I can show you pictures of what they looked like. So there's John Wycliffe. He was an Englishman born in England in 1320, lived until he was 64 years old in 1384. He was trained at Oxford. Yes, the same Oxford you can go to today. He was trained at that school in law and theology, became an expert in those areas, received his degree of doctor in theology from the School of Oxford, and early in his life started having problems with the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. While he was studying theology, he was someone who didn't just study the current languages of the day, but also became an expert in Greek and in Hebrew, and started reading a lot of the original languages that the Bible was written in. And that started him to question a lot of things. In 1374, he made a trip to Rome. He was actually selected as part of an embassy from the church in England, not the Church of England, that doesn't exist yet, but from the church in England, he was selected as part of this embassy to go to Rome and to kind of talk to them and work things out. He was by far the premier theologian of England at that time. And so he goes to Rome and he sees this terrible corruption of the priesthood and the things that are going on. He's very upset by what he views as this just gross accumulation of wealth. The church is by far the most wealthy organization on earth at this time. And most of the leaders of the church, the archbishops and the pope certainly, are some of the richest people on the planet at this time. And it just really gets to him by not only are they so rich, but how opulent everything is. Okay? After all, what are we just coming out of? The Dark Ages, where most people are struggling to live day by day. Famine is all over. We've just gone through the Black Plague of Europe. Okay, the Black Death has hit, and you know, as many as a third of the population. Some cities have died from that. And now all of a sudden, he makes this trip to Rome, and everything is gold, and you know, the feasts are just unbelievable. But yet, the common people on the street are not allowed to partake in those things, and it really just gets him fired up. So, and this is all, you may notice there, that by the time he goes to Rome for the first time, by the time he goes to Rome for the first time, he's already 54 years old and is only going to live till he's 64. So most of his life he has been questioning in his own head some of the practices and some of the teachings that the Roman Catholic Church is imposing, but has been pretty quiet. Until he goes to Rome and sees this opulence, he immediately comes home and gets to work in changing some things. So almost all of his work that we know about was really done in the last 10 years of his life. He is primarily the first one who puts forward this idea. He doesn't call it sola scriptura, but he puts forth this idea that the Bible is the only source of truth. That's pretty radical for the time. Where does truth come from? From the Pope and from your priest. That's right. Your priest tells you what is truth, not the Word of God. If you want to know if something is right or wrong, you go to the church and you ask your priest, and he will tell you. He made this very famous quote here, which you may have heard before. He was approached one time if he believed that it was known that he did not believe in the authority of the hierarchy of the church. And so someone point blank asked him, is the Pope right? And he made this statement. Even though there were 100 popes, and though every mendicant monk were a cardinal, they would not be entitled to confidence only insofar as they accorded with the Bible. For those of you who are not used to reading the New King James Version, that may sound like a wordful, but essentially he's saying that I don't care how many popes and how many cardinals there are, they have absolutely no authority unless they what? Agree with the Bible. Okay, that's right. Now, to us, what does that sound like? Well, that's right. I mean, that's natural, right? But to them, this was like, what are you saying? How dare you say that the Pope doesn't have authority? It was a big deal. He followed that idea and his teaching with this idea that every person should be able to read the Bible for themselves and decide what the Bible says and decide what it means for themselves. He was the first person to translate the Bible into English. He translated the New Testament. It's thought mostly by himself, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, exclusively on his own. He translated those from the original Greek, I believe using the Vulgate version, into English. And then he had a little bit of help with the rest of the epistles. And then, of course, he had by this time, he's got kind of a little bit of a following, and he has several assistants who help him with the translation of the Old Testament. And the Old Testament takes about 2 years. He translates the New Testament with the help of a few people in under 6 months from Greek into English. Quite an accomplishment for the time. He claimed that the church should be as poor as it was in the first century. He had access to a lot of those original Greek writings that we've already talked about. And he saw the condition of the church and how they served the people. He also said that it was wrong for leaders to be more wealthy than anyone in their congregation. Okay? That any leader of the church who had someone in that congregation who was poorer than them, what should they be doing? Sharing. That's right. What did the apostles do? Well, what was done by everybody, they gave their money to the apostles, right? So that everybody shared in common. The apostles themselves worked to feed themselves. And he really believed that this was true. He started a group of poor preachers. They were called Lollards. And he would organize these group of poor preachers who, in order to become part of this, you had to sell everything you had, and you had to take a vow of poverty. The only way you ate was if you went to a place and preached, and the people there were nice enough to feed you. In order to become part of this group. He also taught that the church had absolutely no place in politics. Civil rulers had God-given authority that were recognized by both Jesus and the apostles. After all, what did Jesus say when he was questioned about taxes? Yeah, that's right. In other words, what was Jesus recognizing? Yeah, the civil authority to have rights over the money and over things that were going on. He recognized that. Who do you think this made him popular with? Not so much the poor people, the nobility. That's right. This made him very popular with the nobility. Because what had happened during the Crusades to almost all of their land? It had been usurped by the church. Now all of a sudden, here comes this guy in England who starts saying, hey, there's no right for them in politics or to have anything. So the nobles start to take everything back from him. He also taught that if you were either a priest or any kind of member of the church, of the clergy, and you were found to be immoral, in other words, you were found to be in sin, that all of your property and everything you had was instantly forfeit to the civil leaders. Oh, man, that made him popular with the poor people. It made him popular with the nobles. But guess who it made him unpopular with? The church, and most specifically, the Pope. He started really speaking out against the Pope. In fact, he is the first person to say that the Pope may be the Antichrist. Okay? And he really gets radical in some of his language. Any clergy that is involved in sin should be cast out from the clergy. And it was the duty of church members to report those clergy that were not living a righteous life to civil leaders so that they could be taken out of the clergy. He viewed that as the responsibility of civil government. Okay? So, in response to these, Pope Gregory the 11th condemns Wycliffe and his teachings in 1377. However, he's not really put to death, he's not really punished, because he's living in England, and guess who's protecting him? All of the nobles, okay, are saying, there ain't no way we're going to do that to this guy. He's teaching what we want to hear. He actually taught against many other teachings of the church that we're not going to go into. He did escape punishment of the church, though, although they tried to kill him several times. and died of natural causes at the age of 64. However, not able to live with his teachings and with the things that he had kind of started going, the church very much so, the Catholic Church very much so rebelled against that. So he is branded as a heretic by this Council of Constance. Basically, it is deemed that the heresy of Wycliffe is a capital offense. And if you are found to be teaching that, or if you are found to be in possession of any of his writings, the church immediately wants you to be put to death. They don't go that far. As we've mentioned already, saints and great teachers, what is the church starting to view their bones as? As things of power, right? So they don't even stop there. They go and the Pope orders his remains to be removed from his tomb, his bones and everything that was left to be burned 3 times so that the ashes can be completely rendered unrecognizable. And then those ashes themselves are to be dumped in the Severn River, which is a river just outside the church where he was entombed. They wanted absolutely no part of this teaching and did everything they could to squash it. However, it is true that many followed his ideas quietly for the next several years. One of those people is a guy named Jan Hus. And here's his picture. He was born in Bohemia, but most of his work was done in the Czech city of Prague. He was born in 1369 and lived through 1415, so born when Wycliffe was almost 50 years old. And he was very much so a follower of Wycliffe's teachings. He again was protected by nobility for a certain amount of time, and the church responded to him because the nation, the Czech nation, and the Bohemian nation, all in that area, we call it Czechoslovakia now, was not nearly as powerful as the English nation was. They could not quite offer the same protection to this guy, Jan Hus. So he was excommunicated in 1411. The entire city of Prague was put under interdiction. You may remember we talked about that last week, where that means that no one in the city of Prague could get married, could be baptized, could receive the Lord's Supper, could receive a prophet funeral rites, any of those things. They were all denied, everyone in the city of Prague, which is a big deal, actually. It was kind of the last weapon of the Catholic Church at the time. So after about 6 months of that, the people don't give him up. In fact, the rulers do a lot of things to try to they try to convince some priests to do it anyway. But eventually, he feels the suffering of the people and leaves the city of Prague on his own and then is captured. So he is brought to trial in 1415. He's taken to France, where the secular leadership is much more under the thumb of the church. In fact, this is the period which Martin Luther later writes as the Babylonian captivity of the papacy, because the Pope is there in France. And his teachings and his writings and Wycliffe's, now it's illegal to have a copy, but the church has a copy, they're read side by side in his trial, and basically they're found to be almost identical. He didn't come up with a lot of new ideas. He almost exactly continued to teach what Wycliffe had been teaching. And remember, what's been true about Wycliffe's writings and his teaching? Automatically a heretic. That's right. It's been banned. Okay. So he is asked to recant, and in one of the great statements of faith that you will find anywhere, he says, "God is my witness that I have never taught that which I have been accused by false witnesses." They taught that some false witnesses came forward to say he taught a whole bunch of things that he never did. "In the truth of the gospel which I have written, taught, and preached, I will die today with gladness." One of the great statements of faith, and they were happy to allow him to do that, and they burned him at the stake. And those very papers that they had used in his trial were the things that they used to start the fire. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's not quite true. He did have some copies of Wycliffe's writings, and those were the beginnings of his teachings. So it's not quite that they both started at the Bible and came to the same place. He was, you could call him a disciple of Wycliffe for all practical purposes. Okay, so those are the two guys who are probably most famous for kicking off this idea of the Reformation, that the Catholic Church might not have all the authority that it says it has. And they are the ones who start this idea of we should be looking at Scriptures and we should be teaching Scriptures in the common language, even translating Scriptures into the language of the people. And so the Reformation is going to start. When is the Reformation period? Well, it's from 1517 to 1648. Basically, you may remember in 1517, Luther publishes his 95 theses on the power and efficacy of indulgences. Okay, kind of the story, although nobody thinks it's true anymore, is that he walked up and nailed them to the door of the church there in Wittenberg. But he publishes these 95 theses, all of which rail against the sale of indulgences and the power of the Pope. And in fact, one of the most famous ones of these, as you may remember, that John Tetzel was selling these indulgences to try to build this great basilica of St. Peter, right? And he comes right out and says, since this Pope is the most wealthy man on the earth, why doesn't he just build it out of his own money instead of taking it from the poor people in these countries? And just directly challenges this idea of the Pope. And then the Reformation ends in 1648 with what are called the treaties, the Peace of Westphalia. And we'll talk more about why there were some treaties needed. So the Reformation period itself is about 131 years of religious and political upheaval. Why do those two have to be tied together? That's right. They were already linked, right? So if you're going to revolt against the church, what are you automatically also revolting against? The Holy Roman Emperor, right? Okay, and those two are married together. So it does start as religious reforms. And we're going to talk about guys like Luther, who even taught that there should not be civil unrest based on his teachings. But yet, as these groups start to rebel against the Roman Catholic Church all across Europe, what is bound to happen? As those leaders start to want to get out from under the thumb of the church, and so they start adopting these ideas of the reformers, the church wants to do what? The Catholic Church wants to keep everybody in line. So they're going to use their political people. Remember, at this time, officially, the only person who can declare war is the Pope, officially. And so that really kicks off two wars that I'm sure you've heard about. The 30 Years' War, which was basically the war for Germany, and the 80 Years' War, which was Dutch people trying to get their independence from Spain. Okay? And both of those wars were ended with those treaties there in 1648. Those treaties also included a lot of religious language, that it was going to be okay to practice these new religions that were forming. As I mentioned, because we're down to 15 minutes, we only have time to cover two of the actual reformers. We're going to cover the most important two, Martin Luther and John Calvin. If you have time and are interested, I would recommend that you look up these other four, or key to the movement. Ulrich Zwingli, who was a contemporary of Martin Luther. Henry VIII, who really wasn't a religious reformer, but played a huge part in getting away from the Catholic Church in England. John Knox, who was later, as far as the teaching of the church in England. And then, of course, the Anabaptist movement. Anybody know what the hereditary descendants of the Anabaptist movement are today? The Amish and the Mennonites. That's right. Are the hereditary descendants of that movement there. So if you have some time, I would strongly recommend that you look up those guys and do some reading. Lots of good information there. The first actual reformer that we're going to talk about is Martin Luther. And, of course, There's what Martin Luther looked like in his younger years. And Martin Luther was born in Germany in 1483. He lived until 1546. He was born of very common parentage. His father was a miner who actually started out working the mines and eventually purchased the copper mine in which he worked. And so he famously said, "I am a peasant son. My father, grandfather, and forefathers have all been peasants." Martin Luther was one of these people who was very much a man of the people. Okay? He identified with and talked to the common man, spoke in their language, which is going to be much different from Calvin. He received an excellent education, though. His father was determined that his son would not follow in his steps, so he was enrolled at the University of Erfurt to study law. However, he changed to the monastery there in town to go study religion. Kind of the legend that goes along with that is that he had a very good friend who was killed by lightning, and that Martin is traveling from one town to another, and this terrible thunderstorm comes through, lightning going on all around, and he gets down on his knees and prays to God, "If you let me survive, I will become a monk." And so he does survive the journey and immediately leaves college and goes and enrolls in the monastery. However, even though he does become a priest in 1507, he really does never leave that university idea, and immediately upon being anointed a priest, leaves the monastery to go start teaching at the University of Wittenberg there. In 1512, he received a Doctor of Divinity, the first one to do so from that college, and is named the lead professor of theology at the College of Wittenberg. Similar to others, his trouble starts in Rome. As part of his studies for that Doctor of Divinity degree, he visits Rome several times between 1510 and 1511, and just like Wycliffe, he is just absolutely appalled at the corruption and the opulence and the amount of wealth and the disparity between the church and the people they're serving and those kind of things. He just is, the luxury which the priests are living in just drives him absolutely crazy. And whenever he graduates from that degree, he really starts to realize that something has to change. Okay? And then, not only does he see all this opulence there in Rome, now he gets back to Germany, and who's coming through Germany selling indulgences, trying to raise more money for the church? John Tetzel. And so it just pushes him literally over the edge. Okay? So he did begin to teach people in the German language. He very much believed that in order to teach in German, he had to study the Bible in its original language in order to be able to speak it in German. And it was those studies that really convinced him of this idea of sola scriptura. He taught for 2 solid years on the book of Psalms, and then 2 more years out of the book of Romans. 4 solid years, he didn't preach a single sermon that was not based on one of those 2 books of the Bible. Oh, I'm sure you're thinking, 2 years of Romans, oh. But what was this for the people at the time? Had they ever even heard scriptures read? Not in their language. It always read in Latin. And guess what? Most of the people had no clue what was going on. What that said. They memorized the Latin words without ever knowing what they meant. This was radical teaching for the time. Okay? He begins to translate the Bible to German in order to publish it. He completes that in 1522, the New Testament. And really, his study for that translation is what led him farther and farther away from Catholic teachings. So he is called in 1521 to go to the Diet of Worms. And no, it doesn't mean dirt. It means the diet is a word that means discussion. So it's what we would call the debate today, a debate. Okay? So he's called to go to the city of Worms and to debate his teachings. They directly reread for him his 95 thesis and some of the other writings, and then ask him if he still believes what he had written. Because essentially, what has he said? The church is wrong. Okay? And so he comes up with a very unique answer, And he says, I need time to think about it. And so they give him the night. He spends the night in prayer and with some of his friends consulting, what should I do? And the next day goes before the council to give his response. And in what is probably Martin Luther's finest moment, he stands up the very first thing of the next day, which there's a couple movies that you can go and watch him, some actor portray him saying this. Unless I am convinced by proofs from the scriptures or by plain and clear reasons and arguments, I can and will not retract, for it is neither safe nor wise to do anything against conscience. Here I stand. I can do no other. God help me. Amen. And then he sits down and doesn't say another word for most of his trial. What a wonderful statement of faith there. So he is excommunicated because of this. They do not kill him on the spot like they had done to Jan Hus. So he goes into hiding for nearly a year until he finds some nobles that are more sympathetic to his cause. Well, during this time of hiding, that's when he translates the rest of the Bible. And then he comes out of hiding and some of these nobles who support him, and he starts to reform the churches in Germany. This is the first time a church is labeled evangelical, is in Germany. And basically it's from the idea of preaching from the Bible. But it's only in places where he's protected. However, what is going to very quickly happen? What do we already say has been created? The printing press. Martin Luther was the very first bestseller. His writings were copied and copied and copied because the printing press was developed where? In Germany. So his writings were copied and copied and distributed, and his teachings very much so started to spread until the entire country of Germany basically breaks free from Roman Catholic rule, and that's the whole reason for the 30 Years' War. Well, what were some of his primary teachings that were so different from what the Catholic Church taught at the time? He really believed in predestination, that everybody who is baptized is part of this invisible church. You can't see it. Okay? The universal church is not something that's visible, and the visible church is not necessarily the same thing. He follows up on Wycliffe's idea that the leader of the visible church could be the Antichrist, and that people of the invisible church would still be there. He greatly promotes sola scriptura, as we talked about, the Bible only. However, he directly teaches that some parts are more important than others. For example, he thinks that the Gospel of John is the most important gospel and should be read only. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are only there as supplemental material, and in any place where he felt that they contradicted the book of John, he believed that they were wrong. The book of Romans was his favorite book. The book of James he called an epistle of straw, not worthy of reading, because it directly contradicts some of his teachings about predestination and works. He even went so far as to slightly change some verses, specifically Romans chapter 3:28, which says that we know that we are saved by faith, not by works, right? Anybody know what change he made? He added the word only. That's right. He put, so we are saved by faith only, even so much to the point that whenever he was challenged on that, he directly stood up and said, yes, that is correct. I know it is not in the original Greek. It is there by my decision alone, and that is sufficient. Pretty arrogant at some points in his life. At some points not, but at some points very much so. He believed very much so in sola fide, which in other words, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, which in other words means only faith is needed for salvation, but if you're predestined, then faith really is what? It's only a sign that you were one of those who were predestined for salvation. He believed very much so that marriage should be for everyone. In fact, he married a former nun and had 6 children. He taught that the icons in the churches were idolatry and that there should never be faith in any physical object. He created the belief of consubstantiation, and that's a mouthful, Try to say in consubstantiation versus transubstantiation. The church, the Catholic Church taught that the emblems of the Lord's Supper were actually miraculously changed, okay, from just common bread to actually the body of Christ and the fruit of the vine or wine into the actual blood. He taught that they were not changed, okay, they're not transformed, but that the body of Christ and the blood of Christ are physically present. Although he did not explain exactly how that works. So that is the teaching of consubstantiation, or in other words, with, okay, instead of transformed. He taught about baptism. He said that it's important in salvation, but yet it is not the act of baptism that is important. Baptism is merely a recognition of the faith that you already have. He was then approached about infant baptism and did not want to cross many of his believers who were baptizing their children for fear of their souls. So basically, he makes up a belief that whenever an infant is baptized, that belief is transferred to that infant at the moment of baptism. Okay, and then that infant will then grow up to believe because they receive belief through that baptism. Just a couple quick other facts, and we got to get to Calvin. Taught that rebellion against leaders was a sin. He didn't support the wars of the Reformation. He probably could have had many more supporters if he did. The nobles kind of abandoned him whenever he said it was wrong for them to rebel. He wrote over 400 works, everything from small pamphlets to these really long books. And he died in February 18th, 1546, and was buried in that very church where he supposedly nailed those theses to the door. Okay. Let's talk quickly here about John Calvin. There's John Calvin with his long beard. John Calvin was born in France, but most of his work was done in Switzerland. He was born to a scholarly family within the church. His father was a notary for the church court, and he had a lot of interactions with hierarch people in the church there in France, so much so that by the time he's 12, he's already hired by the local bishop as a clerk, someone who's writing and doing his letters and those kind of things, because he was already very educated by the age of 12. However, his father did not want him to enter to the priesthood and took him out from the service to that bishop and sent him off to college. He studies in the universities of Paris, Orleans, and I'm not sure how you say that last one. He studied law, theology, the Greek language and the Greek classics, the Hebrew language, Latin. He studied all of those things his entire life. In fact, even whenever he leaves, and he later on founds a school in order to keep teaching. He wasn't a man of the people, though, like Luther was. He was a man of academia, and he taught like one. He always spoke to learned people. In fact, it was mentioned of him several times that Calvin spoke to the learned at all times. Even when he was speaking to masses of people, he talked over their head most of the time. He was converted to the Reformation movement at 25 and was forced out of France because he started to preach against the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, the very bishop that he had served as a clerk threatens to kill him, and so he leaves and moves to Geneva. Just like now, Switzerland was neutral ground. So they all the reformers would go to Geneva if they were being chased. He has perhaps the most impact on the Reformation. If Luther started it, then Calvin influenced the most. His five primary teachings are the foundation of most Protestant groups even yet today. And I'm not sure how much farther we'll get past this. I've only got three more slides. His primary teachings have been summarized by the word tulip. Okay? And there shouldn't be that other P in there, sorry. Not tuplip. So tulip, total hereditary depravity. In other words, everybody inherits what? Original sin. Unconditional election. You are chosen by God or you are not, and guess what you have to say about it? Absolutely nothing. Limited atonement. Jesus died only for those who are already chosen. That's right. Okay. Irresistible grace. If you are chosen, guess what? You're going to believe. That's right. You don't have a choice. Okay. And the perseverance of the saints follows along that if you can only be chosen by God, then once you are chosen, guess what? You can never be unchosen. That's right. So no matter what you do, you will go. Bear with me for 1 second. He goes to Geneva. Basically, the city council agrees with him. And anybody who didn't agree with Calvin gets kicked out of the city or sometimes killed. There's a dispute in the Lord's Supper. People who can't understand some of the things he's teaching about the Lord's Supper. So they drive him out in 38. They ask him back in 41. And essentially, they make him the supreme ruler of the city of Geneva. They set up all kinds of rules, things like if you owned an inn, you couldn't serve alcohol, you had to have a copy of the Bible present for anyone who wanted it. No one could be on the city streets after 9 o'clock, unless you were a spy for Calvin. Then you could be out all you wanted. And things like dice were completely forbidden from the town and all kinds of things. Okay, it's interesting that the very persecution he fled, as soon as he gets in power, what does he do? Starts the exact same thing. If you don't agree with him, then you have to get out. Okay? And he doesn't really start his own church like Luther does. However, he does take control of the city of Geneva until he dies in 1564. Oh, thank you.